Our guest today is someone who knows exactly what happens when we spend too much time glued to our screens. He's a psychologist, an author and science communicator who spent years studying the effects of video games on our brains, separating, though, the myths from the facts.
And his first book, Lost in a Good Game, explores the emotional and cognitive impact of gaming. And his latest book, Unlocked, dives even deeper into the science of screen time, tackling the big questions about how our digital lives shape us. Please welcome to the Gadget Show podcast for a fascinating conversation, Professor Pete Etchells.
Hi, team. How are you doing?
Great to
We're
see
good,
you.
Good, thanks. Lovely to good. Have you along, Pete. Thank you for your
thank
time.
Thank you for having me. Yeah, it's great to be here.
We're both very excited about this. Let's get stuck into the first book, if I may.
Sure.
Lost in a Good Game, as Jace mentioned there. It argues that gaming can be a force for good. So what was it that inspired you to start exploring that angle? Was it the amount of negativity that, you know, swirled around the press?
I can pinpoint the moment that not the moment that I decided to write that book, but the moment that I decided to become a video games researcher. And it was in the pub on a Friday evening around about 2012, I think. And I'd read I think it was a Daily Mail headline. And I use it a lot in the talks that I do still. So the headline was "Computer Games Leave Children with Dementia," warns top neurologist. And it really irritated me because there was no research then to support that statement. There is still no research now that shows that computer games leave kids with dementia. So that was wrong. And the person who was saying it was not a top neurologist. They were a neuroscientist and they're different things. So everything about that headline was wrong and it really irritated me. And I went to the pub and I got a bit drunk and I started ranting about it. And one of the professors, I was doing my PhD at the time, and one of the professors in the department said, well, you know, basically, shut up, Pete. Why don't you put your money where your mouth is and do some research on it?
Oh, that's so cool!
Yeah, and I know it sounds like a bit of a weird, like cliched thing to say, but like it wasn't like an epiphany moment. But you know, I've always been a video game player, and I'd never really thought about it interacting with my work life until that point. You know, my PhD was on a very different topic. It was all about how our eyes move, basically how our brains control our eye movements. But at that point, I was like, yeah, no, that could be cool actually. If there's people not doing this sort of work but saying this sort of stuff, how do we fix that? How do we do research in the area that addresses these questions, and how do we communicate it in a way that doesn't terrify everybody? So yeah, and then that's sort of how I got here, really.
Right, before we jump back to talking more tech, let's talk about a game changer for staying connected while traveling. Our sponsor for today's episode, Saily.
Yeah, if you've ever been abroad and battled outrageous roaming charges, sketchy hotel Wi-Fi, or the stress of finding a local SIM, I have done that in dodgy markets, Saily has you covered. It's a global eSIM service that gives you affordable mobile data in over 190 countries, hassle-free. I didn't even know there were 190 countries, so there you go.
I've been to 190 countries.
I bet you have.
Every year. So all you have to do is download the Saily app, pick a data plan for your destination, activate your eSIM, and boom, that's it. You're online the moment you land. No queues, no contracts, no nasty surprises. And as a Gadget Show listener, you'll get 15% off 15 your first purchase with the code THEGADGETSHOW at checkout.
I'm also a fan of a spontaneous weekend getaway, Susie. I know I don't look like I am, but I am. But I refuse to get stung by those ridiculous UK roaming fees. With Saily, I just activate a plan for wherever I'm heading. Recently, and quite seriously, it was Spain, and I used it, and it was great. No extra costs, no stress, whether it's a city break in Berlin or a road trip to Gay Paris.
Ooh, I could do with one of those right now. I'm just about to go to Thailand, not quite the same thing. Now, it's way cheaper than traditional roaming, and you only pay for what you need. So whether you're planning a trip or just wanting a backup data plan that works worldwide, check out Saily at saily.com. All the details are in the episode description, or if you're watching, you can scan the QR code on the screen now. What are the surprising psychological benefits that people might not think of when it comes to gaming, then, that you can tell us about?
So, I don't think they're surprising to people who play video games. I think they might be surprising to people who don't understand video games, and I think there's the problem, right?
Yeah.
But I have a really great quote in my first book. So I interviewed Tracy King, who's she's a like an indie games developer, and she does all sorts of other stuff as well. She's brilliant. And she said, you know, I play video games because games are fun and I like to do fun things. And she phrased it in a slightly different way. So I think she said, yeah, people come up to me sometimes and say, oh, you don't look like a gamer. And she said, oh, you're basically saying you don't look like somebody who enjoys things. And it's that, really. That's the very dull answer, right? They are entertainment. They're a really immersive, engaging form of entertainment. And I think the thing that sets video games apart from other forms of entertainment media is the sense of agency that it gives you. Right, you can really get into a movie and you can be annoyed with the antagonist, and you can like really root for the hero and stuff like that, and be affronted when things go wrong. But in a video game, you're the hero, right? So it's not that you can see something playing out on a screen that impacts somebody else, it's impacting you. And obviously, like, we know that there's a separation there, that you're not actually the person in the game. But that's the idea. You have control over your actions. You can decide in a lot of games the way that the story goes or what you decide to do. And that means that when you get into those games, you really get into them, and they can impact you on like a really emotional level. And one of the things that I talk about in Lost in a Good Game is this idea of, it sounds really rubbish in many ways. I hate this phrase in a lot of ways. It sounds very kind of airy-fairy, but I kind of say this thing that video games allow us to explore what it means to be human, which is a very silly thing to say, but I kind of mean it in some ways, that what games give you is a space to explore different outcomes and different aspects of being a person. You know, you can be a bad guy in some games. You can do horrible things in some games. You can do what would be perceived to be immoral things. And what that allows you to do is almost sort of check your moral compass in a way.
Doesn't that pertain, that and your remark about the agency it offers us, isn't that where people start to question the link, the supposed link between video games and violence?
Yeah, and I think that is partly where it comes from, that games do feel different to other forms of media in that sense. But I think what that worry fundamentally misses, again, is that sense of agency, that these aren't things that just happen to you in a game. You know what's going on. You can understand the difference between a game and reality. And it allows you to do those sorts of things in a relatively safe space. Right. So, it's an argument that's similar to the one in the 1980s and 1970s of like being worried about kids watching Tom and Jerry because Tom and Jerry is really violent. You know, kids know the difference between cartoons and reality, and yeah, they might act them out sometimes, but that doesn't mean that they become more violent people, more aggressive people, because of that interaction that they become desensitized. But it's a really weird research area that looks at violence in games and aggression, right?
The one thing I would say though is, and I think we should take account of, we've talked a lot about the psychology, but the physiological implications of playing a lot of games are real. And I'll give an example without getting specific, but regular listeners to the show can probably work out that a certain member of my family plays games for a living, and therefore that person is in a chair in a room a lot longer period of time every day than, you know, someone else in there you know, at the same age would be. And you know, and also the sort of the great experiment of how phones affect eyesight, for example. So if we're looking, if broadening it away from gaming specifically, but to, you know, device use, I always wonder if we're going to find out somewhere down the line that it's affecting us, you know, at a sort of ocular level, that it's going to, we're going to have a lot of kids getting glasses at an earlier age. I don't want to sound like the very people that we're trying to educate, if you like, in this conversation, but I think it's a fair point to make.
Yeah, I think, and this is where it's difficult talking about these things quite a lot, because it's very easy to come across as dismissive and say, oh, that thing that you're worried about, or that thing that seems to be obvious, nah, there's no good research to support that. And I think we need to be really careful of not doing that in this space, because there are things that are not great for you. You know, the one that you said is a classic one of being stuck in your chair for however many hours if you're playing video games or whatever. It's absolutely right. Whether that necessitates playing less or whether that necessitates doing something else to mitigate it is the interesting question there, right? So yeah, 10, 12 years ago, there was a review paper that came out. So one of the big researchers in this area is somebody called Daphne Bevallier, who was talking about, and you see this analogy quite a lot in the literature, asking, you know, what the effects of video games are on us, on our health, say, is kind of like asking, what's the effect of eating food on my waistline? And it's a silly question to ask, because the answer is, it depends, right? It depends what, you know, what are you doing? What are you eating? How much are you eating? Who are you eating with? How much exercise are you doing? And you can kind of apply that to video games as well, and digital tech more generally. And there's a great researcher at Cambridge called Amy Auburn, who talks about this a lot, thinking about these sorts of things in terms of our digital diet. So not just what we're consuming, but when. Not even just how much, but how much in what context. You know, you think about a protein bar, for instance. This is where the analogy is going to break down, because I don't do any exercise, so this is where it goes wrong. But think about a protein bar, like really calorie dense food. Is that a good or a bad thing for you to eat? It depends, right?
That's so
are you training for a marathon or something like that, and you're eating it to keep calories up? It's going to be fine. It's not really going to impact your weight or your waistline in any meaningful way, but it's going to give you energy that you need. Are you in bed at midnight, having not really done anything that day, and you've got two protein bars next to you, you're just munching through them before you go to bed? Probably
disaster.
Not a good idea.
Disaster. Yes.
But the good or the bad of the
sounded
protein
like you're
bar,
talking from experience there, Suze.
I've got a thing about protein bars. As soon as you said it, I'm like, oh. But seriously, unless you're doing like hardcore training, there's so much carb in them. It's you're better off having, you know, some eggs after you've been training. But that's another story entirely.
But that's the thing, right? It's not. Is the protein bar a good or a bad thing? Depends on other factors. It's not inherent in the thing itself. And I think this is one of the things that we struggle with on a, in terms of the broad debate, in terms of video games and social media and whatever, is that we're kind of told, or we're kind of led to believe, that these things are inherently harmful. And I don't think they are. I don't think that's the right way to think about them. So in my second book, I talk about digital addictions and things like that, and I don't think addiction is the right way to frame our thinking on these forms of technology. I think a better way of thinking about them is in terms of habit formation. So habits in and of themselves are neutral. Whether they become good or bad depends on other things, and how you help yourself in that sense then is to be more aware of what you're doing and when and why. You know, if you catch yourself playing video games for 5 hours in an evening when you get home from school or work, and that's the first thing you want to do, and you want to kind of shut the world out, and the next thing you know, it's midnight. I miss those days. I don't do that anymore. But if you're not happy with that, if you get to the end of that session and you feel regret, or you feel as though it's not been healthy for you, catching yourself in that moment and trying to interrogate what led to that, why were you playing so much? Can you do anything about that? How do you reduce your gaming time but still play? So we're not talking about getting rid of it completely. Reduce it in a meaningful way, but stop using it as perhaps an unhelpful coping strategy for something else that needs to be addressed. They're not easy conversations to have, right? That's really difficult stuff, but it'll help you in the long run.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I mean, that is supposing that people can take responsibility for that and climb out of whatever hole they're in. Supposing they are in a hole,
easy at all.
And clearly, during those 5 hours, there's probably things that they haven't done that they should have done, and that kind of thing. I want to just reframe this a little bit and go back to, you know, a lot of people watching this podcast have got kids. Jace touched on it earlier. In terms of screen time for gaming, let's just be specific about gaming here. Is there scientifically a healthy amount of gaming time that, you know, ish, that kids should do? Or is it one of those questions that's just so dependent on various different things, because they might not only do it once a week or you know, whatever?
So the short answer there is no, but. So there's no guidelines or science anywhere that supports that, you know, if you have 2 hours of gaming per day, you know, if you dink over that, then that's where things start to go bad. There was a study that came out a few years ago that looked at this and called it, it was called the testing the digital Goldilocks hypothesis, right? So they looked at various forms of screen time, including video games, and look at the association with well-being. And what you find is a what's called an inverted U-shaped curve. So low levels of video game play are associated with lower levels of well-being. This is in children. Really high levels of video game time are associated with low levels of well-being, but not as low as none at all. And then you kind of get this peak, and it's around about, well, it depends what time of the week you're talking about. I think it's something like a couple of hours. I think it was 4.5 hours total per day for screen time. I can't remember the specific number for video games. That was picked up in the news as, you know, 4.5 hours is the point at which things start to go bad. And I don't think that's the right way of thinking about that sort of study. It's thinking about what are you doing, why are you doing it, and what the balance is with other things. So I think we could all agree that, like, if you're just playing video games all day every day, that's not a good thing. For physically, it's not a good thing. Probably in terms of your mental health, it's not a good thing. That's true of everything, right? You know, if you do a single thing and you do it to the exclusion of everything else, that would always be a red flag for me that something's going wrong there. When you start getting it down to, should it be an hour, should it be 2 hours, there's no science to support that. So what needs to happen then is open conversations in the home, talking about how much time kids want to play video games and why, what are they getting out of it, talking to them about how you feel about that and what you would like the boundaries and expectations to be, and trying to set those expectations, set those rules in such a way that you get buy-in from your kids, that they're on board with it.
I mean, I think these are important conversations, because I think we have to ask the question as well, that in the adult, where has that learned behavior come from, whereby you understand that you've done enough and you can turn it off? That comes from parenting. And I talk from bitter experiences. Some of the biggest rows we've had, or the most difficult conversations we've had with our kids, have been around video games. And actually, I was going to say, and other types of content, but mainly video games. And you know, look, I'm the world's biggest advocate for video games, okay? Was on the BAFTA panel, been in video games, got world records for video games, have all the consoles, love it, blah, 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 right? Yeah. But I've got to be realistic, right, and say that these games are designed by experts, especially some of the pay-to-play models, you know, the free games where their income is based on your player time and or your ability to get into a kind of narrative that requires you to spend micro amounts of money over time, right? But these are adults with sophisticated, you know, mathematics, and they are targeting young people. That is a thing. That's a real thing. So we do need to draw this line, don't we? Which we're doing between, you know, you and I and Susie and a 14-year-old who's got homework to do, and whose parents want to have a chat and, you know, want to find out what they did with their day and so on. And it's parenting, and it's that stage in their life, I believe, and possibly even younger. And we've all seen the bad examples of the child sat in the restaurant with the iPad, right? Which is a kind of, you know, I'm not castigating you. People have lives, they have difficult challenges for whatever, but you get my point. I'm using it as a crass example. Those moments are where the learned behavior that keeps you healthy when you're older, that's where it comes in, isn't it?
I have a real problem with monetization models for video games. So I've done research on this. I've done research on the relationships between loot boxes and gambling behaviours and mental health and things like that. There's a lot of focus, both in terms of research, but also in terms of potential policies and regulations around loot boxes and loot box type elements. I worry that happens because they're kind of a low-hanging fruit. Like, literally in some games they look like a one-armed bandit, right? And you're like, come on, people, like, stop this. The thing that I really worry about that is getting relatively less attention, particularly in research, is things that don't look obviously like gambling, but play into potential psychological vulnerabilities. Primarily, you mostly see it in mobile games. You see it a lot in mobile games. So I always worry about any game that's free, but you can do in-app purchases, because very often they don't look anything like gambling. So the problem with loot boxes started because there was a big discussion around whether they should be included in the UK Gambling Act, because they look and feel like gambling. What about things like, so I talk about this in both of my books, games where, like, match three puzzles on your phone, right? So you have games where there's like an infinite number of levels, and you have a, you know, if you ever go at trying to pass a level and you lose a life, and so you got five lives, and those lives replenish over time, so it might take an hour for a life to replenish, right? Or you can spend £1 to replenish them all now. At face value, so that's nothing to do with gambling there. There's no gambling element in there. You pay knowing what you're going to get, right? And on the face of it, it looks like this is something that would actually help break gaming cycles, because if you lose all five lives and you've got to wait 5 hours or whatever, you literally can't play the game for that time, so you got to have a break. So it seems like a good thing. It seems like a good way of limiting game time. It actually plays into a lot of psychological vulnerabilities that everybody has. So there's this concept called hedonic adaptation, right? And there's studies that have shown this using chocolate. So very simply, if you take two groups of people, and at the start of the week you give one group as much chocolate as they want to eat through the week. You say, go wild, do whatever you want. And the other group, you say, you're not allowed to eat any chocolate for the next week. And then a week later, you bring them back into the lab and you give them a plate of chocolate and you measure how much they eat. And what you tend to find is that the group that's had unrestricted access through the week, they eat about the same that they would usually or less. The restricted access group eat more. They consume more because they've had that thing that they want to enjoy, they've been withheld from it, so they'll bounce back, basically.
You've created a need, really, haven't you?
Yeah. So hedonic adaptation is basically this idea that you kind of have a level of liking stuff that you're at, and if you deviate away from that, you'll try and get back to that point. So if you're restricted, you'll eat more. If you can't play the game, you'll play more later on. So there's little elements like that, and other elements like what we call variable ratio rewards and things like that, when you win things in games just enough times to keep playing, which are very similar to elements of casino games. But it's not clear that the monetary transaction could ever be classed as gambling. But it leads to people spending ridiculous amounts in games. And because we're talking about things that can be generated ad infinitum, like you can always add another character or another outfit to a game, and you can always make one of those outfits really desirable literally by saying that it's rare and making it rare, that there's infinite content in these things, which means that there's infinite potential for people to pay money. And there, you know, you see like crazy stories like was it Diablo, the mobile Diablo game, a few years ago, somebody worked out that in order to get this particular piece of legendary armor, to guarantee that you were going to get it, you'd have to spend something like $500,000.
Yeah, I was going to say, I don't know whether this will surprise people listening who've got kids, or maybe you'll have a similar story, but, you know, I'm embarrassed to say that I've had one instance of a bill for several hundred pounds from one of my kids on a mobile game.
Wow. And it's so easy to do, it's such a wild west. And I think that is the area where we need to, like, no game is worth £200 or £500 or £500,000. Like, it's just, no game is ever worth that. What I feel has happened is that developers have moved away from the fundamental reason why games exist, which is to facilitate play. And play is one of the most important things that we can do, not just as kids, but as adults as well. It's so good for your well-being to play in appropriate ways. But these games have moved towards
Revenue generators.
Revenue generation.
Yeah.
And what that means, if you look at this in terms of research that looks at well-being, games, when done well, they satisfy what we call a bunch of psychological needs. So if you within a game, if you have autonomy, so the ability to sort of do whatever you want and have relative freedom, if you have what's called relatedness, so socialization, basically, you can talk to other people, you can interact with them, and competence. So there's like a good learning curve. You can feel as though you're doing well. It's not too hard that you get really frustrated all the time. It's not too easy that you find it boring. If you meet those sorts of needs, which are kind of what we call intrinsic motivational needs, they often tend to be linked to positive well-being. Extrinsic motivations, so things like you play a game because you want to get something cool because it's been designated as cool, and in order to get that thing you have to log in every day, but you don't really want to that day, but you need to, or you have to pay something to get something that you think will help. You're doing things not for those sort of self needs, but there's these sort of external motivators linked with lower levels of well-being, and games are moving more towards those extrinsic external motivation systems, and I don't think developers really thinking about what the impact that has on player bases. And yeah, you get into this really weird space, right, where everybody hates loot boxes, right? I don't really know many people that like them. I think there's a subgroup of people who really like loot boxes as a game within a game. Like, you see it as like a collectible card game type element of something bigger. But, you know, most of the time you talk to gamers and they hate them. But we still play them and we still use them. And I'm not really quite sure why we're in that space at the minute and why we're not shouting more about what games should be for people.
Old school games, gaming nostalgia seems to have gained so much traction. I mean, we've covered it a lot on our podcast, and we
really
noticed
popular,
the massive spike if we do anything old school and nostalgic. Is it the nostalgic element of you know, playing old school games that plays this sort of positive mental health role that we're seeing?
Yeah, I think that's an element of it, certainly. Like I'm in my early 40s now. My back turned 76 the other day. Not got a good back at the minute. And I found myself doing this a lot, right? You're looking back on games of the past, not just games, but like cartoons, TV shows, sort of reminiscing about those sorts of things. And yeah, with a really positive lens. And I think we do, you know, there's various sort of psychological studies that show this, that we kind of tend to look, the older we get, we tend to look more favorably back on stuff that happened in the past. We kind of remember the positives a little bit more and forget the negatives. So I think, yeah, that absolutely plays into it. But I think part of it is also that people crave contained gaming experiences, right? One of the things that we've lost, not completely, but that, you know, games are never complete anymore, right? That you can play, you basically play games now until you burn out, until you get bored and exhausted of them, because there's always new content coming out. There's always new DLCs, there's always new maps or whatever. Whereas sometimes you just want a contained experience.
Yeah, you want to experience
a story.
You want to get to the end, you want a boundary, you want to be able to say that you claimed that. And yeah, I agree. I was actually on my arcade machine yesterday. I was playing Breakout, which is, Breakout was big. When would you say you were born?
I was 1983.
Right, so it would have been big before you were even born. It was in the late 70s. I can't remember, but Atari's Breakout, like 79, you could definitely play it on the Atari 2600, so that would have been before 1980. And I was absorbed by it for an hour. I mean, okay, interestingly, the version I was playing was part of something called the Atari 50, which is a collection to celebrate the 50th anniversary of Atari, and it's a collection of all of their classic games with a kind of like a museum interface, but they've also refreshed a lot of the titles, and this was one of them. So you start playing old school Breakout, and then it adds a little bit of new school to it, so it kind of moves the perspective of the game and the colors are a bit more vivid, but effectively it's just a physics game. Can I get my bat in the right position to bounce the ball back, like Pong, you know? I think what we're experiencing, Susie, with the success of the podcast that we do that feature retro gaming and retro content, is exactly what you're talking about. Our audience obviously are getting older, and if your research is correct, then they're looking back and they're looking to relive those simpler, boundaried experiences.
Mm. But also some of them were just like really great games. Like,
yeah,
really, really good mechanics. And at the same time, some of them were awful. Like I've gone back and tried to play some games that I thought I really liked as a kid, and I was like, these are impossible. And it's kind of what I'm trying to do with my daughter at the minute. So my daughter's 5. It's not working very well because I just don't think she's interested in video games. But I keep trying. But I got one of the SNES minis.
Yeah.
When they first came out, and we've been playing games on that. We've been playing things like Kirby and old school Mario and stuff. Things that are really hard games, but they're the things that I grew up on and that I kind of loved first. And part of it is that they're more simplistic experiences, I think, as in terms of a learning curve of getting into games. I feel like they're easier to get into when you've got a D-pad and a couple of buttons, basically, rather than an entire PC and an entire keyboard of stuff. But they're a shared experience. You know, I can talk to her about how I play this and when I played this when I was a kid. Like I say, she's a bit bored by that, so it's not working. But I think, you know, it's nice to be able to go back to those and relive those experiences and share them. And I think that's one of the big things about games, is that we often think that they are, certainly people who don't play them, you look at somebody playing a video game and it looks like a really isolating, jarring experience in many ways. And video games forever have been considered as something that isolates people. But right from the early days of games being developed, they've always been shared experiences, right? You look at like the International Space War Olympics in the 70s and stuff.
Amazing. Yeah.
MIT, like, was it MIT?
And arcades.
They invent a game, and first thing that happens is a bunch of people come together to play it. And yeah,
exactly.
Arcades, people kind of congregate. Yeah. Like, they've always been social experiences. And I think part of the reason why we struggle to talk about that is that we don't have a particularly good way of talking about games in a way where people who don't play them can understand them. You know, there's a huge barrier to entry for playing video games. Like, if you've never seen a movie before and you want to get into movies, you just sit down and turn the TV on and there will be a movie somewhere, right? You just need to watch it. And if you don't like it, it's rubbish, you just need to watch another one. If you think about, like, if you want to get into video games, you know, I decide, having never played anything before, I'm going to get a PlayStation 5. You know, you get it out of your box, try and figure out how to plug it in, turn it on, ask for the Wi-Fi code, and the first thing that happens is it spends like 2 hours updating itself. And then you put a game in, and then the game spends 2 hours updating to the latest version. And then finally you get to play, you've got to figure out the control system, you've got to get through the like learning levels effectively. And it can be like maybe 2-3 hours before you get to a point in a game where you're invested, you understand what's going on, you understand the systems, and you're in the flow. Yeah, that's quite a big barrier if you've never played them before.
It is now.
I think it's things like that disconnect people from it. And
but it wasn't, was it? It was a Mega Drive and a cartridge. Click one button, bang. And well, how about the older Atari 2600 I mentioned? One button and a stick. Anyway.
That sounds like a very good moment to almost wrap things up. So Pete, where can people follow your work? And have you got anything up and coming project-wise that we should keep our eye on?
So I'm in all the usual places. So kind of my handle in most places is at Pete Etchells. My website is PeteEtchells.com. So at the minute I'm kind of focused on smartphone research at the minute. So I'm doing some work around do smartphone bans in schools work in the way that we want them to, or think that they do? Do they have the intended impacts? So I'm kind of doing quite a lot of work in that space at the minute around, if we do go down the regulation route, how do we do that in a sensible way that doesn't impact on children's rights? Because that's another thing that's sort of forgotten in these conversations a lot. When we talk about banning kids from phones completely, they have a right to access the internet. They have a right to access the internet in a safe way. So how do we actually enable that without just removing it all from them? So I'm doing stuff like that at the minute. got an idea for another book, but it's so embryonic at the minute that I'm not going to tell anybody.
Come back and tell us later another time. Yeah. Pete, it's been a great pleasure to listen to you and your views, and thank you so much for sharing.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me.